This podcast is from heptagonclub.co.uk and paulcarenza.com. The Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza. 7 guests, 7 corners.
On this week's show,
everybody thinks it's a cute Christmas song. It's actually a Thanksgiving song about drink driving and picking up women.
Urchins and mob caps and sooty-faced children skipping in the street.
Yeah, I'm just doing a podcast.
And your host,
Mr. Paul Carenza.
Hello, Merry Christmas season's greetings. Happy Advent, because it's still early in December. It's not Christmas by a way yet. But hello to you. Welcome to our Christmas special. Well, the first of, in theory, 2 Christmas specials of the Heptagon Club. It's lovely to have you with us. If you've joined us for the first time, you're particularly welcome. I have a suspicion that we may have a few first-time listeners joining us as well, just from people I've been chatting to at gigs and things. So you're particularly welcome. If this is your first time, we generally have 7 guests per episode here, but this is going to be a little bit unusual. Normally, Christmas specials on TV, on radio, you have extra guests to make it seasonal and guest-like. Well, here we normally have 7 already, which is ample and far too many for me to edit and or serve drinks and canapes to. So I thought as a Christmas special, we would have fewer guests than usual. So I was originally planning to sort of do something a little bit based on this new book that I've been hawking on here for a few episodes now. It's called Hark, The Biography of Christmas, if you're one of the few people who I've not yelled at about it already. It's new out for this season. It's the history of Christmas told in book form. And I thought in a sort of pod equivalent, given the guest scenario and premise of this podcast, I thought it might be fun to sort of delve into a few historical festive guests. So the people who have made the modern Christmas what it is, really. So we're going to delve into a little bit of that. But also, I thought it would be good to meet a couple of actual live people. And they are fantastic. I had an opportunity to speak to them. James Cooper runs the whychristmas.com website and is the fount of all knowledge in things festive. And then I had the chance to speak to Justin Edwards, who is a bit of a comedy legend, really, and indeed acting superstar. He's a film star. He's a bona fide film star. He would say screen actor, or I would say big screen actor, because he's very big. And he's currently in 3 films at the box office, can you believe it? Death of Stalin, Paddington 2, and conveniently for this episode, The Man Who Invented Christmas, the story of Dickens writing A Christmas Carol, in which Justin plays Dickens' literary agent. So we'll be hearing more from Justin later on about that. But yeah, so I thought I'd delve into a few of the festive historical innovators who really, you know, presented us with the modern Christmas in different ways. For example, I'm going to go with a saint, open the bidding with a saint, not Saint Nicholas. No, I'm going to go with the other one. Who could that be, you're thinking? Saint Francis of Assisi, that guy, known, I suppose, for looking after animals, looking after the poor as well. But I think in a couple of key ways he gave us a modern Christmas. One of them is he gave us songs not in Latin. That includes particularly carols as well, of course. He gave us, you know, Christian hymns, but in local languages, in Italian in his case, and then in French and in English. His other monks were out writing these songs. It was about the 1200s, 1100s, 1200s. And suddenly then the people owned the songs a bit. They could actually understand what they were singing about in church, and they were then writing their own poems and songs and plays, and then you get the Coventry plays, the mystery plays, and people taking ownership of the Christmas story. The other thing he did is gave us the first Christmas crib scene, the first live nativity scene with actual donkeys and an ox and an ass and a stone Mary and Joseph and his monks playing shepherds. He had some monk friends. We've all got good monk friends. When you need a shepherd, you get a monk, it's what you do. And ever since then, across Europe at the time, every major household of note wanted their own live nativity, life-size live nativity scene. And since then, we now have the smaller versions that sit on our shelves, like the one right in front of me here, in fact, so that's quite nice. So, St. Francis of Assisi, that's my opening bidding for people who have given us the modern Christmas. It's time, I think, we had a real live guest, and thankfully we have one here, in James Cooper. Hello, James.
Hello, Paul.
How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. And I'm getting in the festive spirit.
Well, aren't you always in the festive spirit?
Pretty much. Yeah, that is true.
Do you slowly build up towards the festive season, or are you kind of year-round kind of...
Well, yeah, I mean, I have what are called Rudolph days, which is the 25th of every month. I use it as an excuse to play Christmas music and do something generally Christmassy throughout the year.
Excellent. I like that. Rudolph days. That's something else, isn't it? I should introduce them. Your website is Why Christmas, is that correct?
Yes, whychristmas.com. whychristmas.com.
Oh, yes, of course, yes, rather than just the letter. Why?
Yes.
Why Christmas? So the obvious question then is, why? Why Christmas?
Okay, that's a very good question. I started the site back in the year 2000, which was when the internet was really a baby compared to what it is now. I had some teacher friends, and they knew I was getting into web-type things, and they came to me and they said, James, why can't we find a child-safe and friendly site that's got Christmas info on it that isn't trying to sell the kids something?
Ah.
Because back then it was kind of like the likes of Disney and Nickelodeon that had sort of the majority of kids' sites. And basically they had kids' sites, but they were really using it to push their DVDs and videos and stuffed toys and whatnot.
Mm.
So I made a site for one school. And it got a couple of hundred hits in the first year, and then sort of Google sort of started picking it up, and now it takes up most of my November and Decembers.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So before that, pre-2000, were you a Christmas nut as well?
Well, as a big kid, you know, I still liked Christmas as a Christmas nut, but I'd always been interested in Christmassy type things, and doing the site sort of sparked my Christmas interest and got me going as to like why we have crackers and trees and cards and all that sort of malarkey. And yeah, it's just grown and grown and grown and grown and grown.
Yeah, good work. Now, because your site is, it's pretty, what's the word, conclusive? It's everything, definitive, that's the word I mean.
Yeah.
There can't be much, I mean, I suppose if you think of something it hasn't got to do with Christmas, then you add it. So it's
yeah.
And so it's all sorts of, it's modern Christmas, history of Christmas, traditions. I see you've even got karaoke on there, Christmas karaoke.
Yes.
All that stuff. I noticed with catering to the American and British audience.
Yes. I mean, because of course, I'm a good Britisher. Mm. And for the first few years I ran the site, when it was mainly Brits looking at it, I spelt colour and things like that correctly with using. but then as soon as Americans got hold of it and lots of American schools started using the site, I had no end of emails from American kids going, you don't know how to spell because you put you in your words.
Excellent impression, by the way. They all sound like that.
So now it really, really pains me, but I spell everything American on there because it just makes my life easier.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I know the feeling. I had to add Z's instead of S's all through the book I've just done, just because they go, well, we'll just get complaints from Americans, whereas Brits just tut, so you can get away with it, can't you?
So, speaking of Americans, here is how we're going to do things. On the next episode, we're going to go a little bit more American-focused, just a little bit. Bit of Santa, bit of shopping, Macy's, KFC even. All to come next time in a couple of weeks, right on the cusp of Christmas. There is the Christmas cusp, I have decreed it so. If you can hear a bit of background noise, I'm doing a Christmas shopping at the minute. Yeah, I'm just doing a podcast. It's like a radio thing, but so sorry, yes, I'm doing a bit of multitasking here. Who says the gents can't do it? So anyway, this time, like I say, this is part one of our festive special. We've got two live guests, as well as five historical figures that I'll be bringing to the table, the Christmas table, historical guests that I think have changed Christmas for better or for ill, including, well, one very dastardly historical character, depending on how you look at things, and that is Cromwell, right? So surely, I think this guy did more than almost anyone to change Christmas. By the time of Cromwell and his Puritan takeover of government in this country, we've had the Reformation 500 years ago this year. Doing down Catholicism, so that of course impacts on Christmas in terms of the status of Mary, the status of saints, including St. Nicholas, of course, so that was all a bit downplayed. Both, thankfully, valiantly clung on to Christmas. But also Cromwell didn't like the excesses at Christmas time. Christmas has become a bit like a party day ever since those medieval kings saw it as an excuse for huge blowouts on a giant banquet. Henry II ordered crane for his dinner table, not a crane to move things in, but just crane, very chewy apparently. Every drink known to man came to him. Tablecloth, in fact, so large that the linen had to be sought from two different counties. So there you go, they've run out of linen, quick, linen crisis. These are weird things to be saying, by the way, in the middle of a shopping centre, but I'm sure they don't mind me. So anyway, at the time of Christmas of Oliver Cromwell, party time outside the church was pretty much too much. Inside the church as well, it was a celebration of the birth of the Messiah, but should we even be celebrating that, I suppose, was the Puritan thought. Many thought, no, only two birthdays in the Bible. Both are celebrated by baddies like King Herod and Pharaoh, and they celebrated by killing people, so that was never good. So maybe birthdays aren't to be celebrated. So Cromwell comes in, bans Christmas in the 1640s. Mince pies are effectively banned as well, so they change shape from this crib shape to the round shape we now have to flout the law banning them. Used to be effigies as well of the Holy Family, hung above each front door in a house, surrounded by evergreens. Potentially idolatrous, though, these effigies of the Holy Family, so bye-bye Holy Family. Evergreen stuck around as mistletoe, and the Christian kiss delivered by the priest beneath the holy effigy was replaced by the mistletoe kiss. So there we have that. On a larger scale, I suppose, when Christmas returned to England, it wasn't as popular as it used to be, because they'd been advertised. It sold even by Father Christmas on the printed propaganda. Father Christmas was used as the figurehead of the rosy English Christmas that Cromwell had banned. But when it came back, it wasn't as rosy as promised. People were getting a bit annoyed, and Christmas wasn't celebrated in the same way. Over in America, they had Christmas banned as well. Pretty much the Puritan Pilgrim Fathers went over, and just Christmas never landed, really, in many parts of the United States, as it was then, or the un-United States. I'm kind of hazy on American history, if I'm honest. So anyway, Thanksgiving sneaks in over there. Hogmanay sneaks in Scotland when they've effectively banned Christmas until about the 1960s. And in England, well, Christmas was on the wane, all thanks to Cromwell.
If you could pick one person, you could maybe pick several people, but do you have one person who you think changed Christmas for the better or for the worse, but, you know, into what we have it today? So I don't know whether, you know, should we take the baby Jesus as red? You know,
yes.
And then since then, in the celebration of Christmas, it's changed a lot and adapted a lot over the years. Can you pick one person who you think...
Dickens. For the Christmas traditions that we have now and that still hold over from Victorian times, I think they were cemented a lot by him and just around that whole sort of 1840s-ness.
It seems a lot happened... Like 1843, you got your Christmas carol, your Christmas cards. I think Come All Ye Faithful was that year as well.
Yeah, like and trees really started to take off then as well.
The Christmas crackers, they were sort of, again, in London as well, around that decade, I think, wasn't it? So, and all in Victorian London, it seems. All in London over those few years.
The Heptagon Club.
Seven guests, seven corners. The Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza.
Still here doing my shopping, so he was known as the man who invented Christmas, which is indeed a great title for a great new film. It's out this week, in fact, and on release day itself, I sat down with our next live guest, who is in it. Ladies and gents, boys and girls, welcome to the Heptagon Club, a bona fide film star, I would say, a star of small and now big screen in a load of films right now. This is Justin Edwards.
Thank you for joining us.
Nice. Happy release day as well, I think, is that right?
It is, right? It is out in cinemas as we speak. I expect people to... quietly flocking.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to have said I've seen it, but obviously it's only out now, and I was going to see it this afternoon, depending on how long we're chatting for, basically. The man who invented Christmas.
Yes.
You must have been doing this in spring or something.
It was exactly this time last year. We filmed it in Dublin in the Christmas of whatever, like 2016 last year. So, yeah, as we speak, which is the 1st December, I would have been there this time last year.
Right.
Romping around in my waistcoat and sideburns. I mean, I think the man who invented Christmas is a slightly, slightly stretched
revived.
The man who reinvigorated Christmas, but it's not quite as catchy. But yes, all the stuff with, you know, well, I didn't realise it was such a minor holiday. It was just like one day off. It was nothing else. It was a bang holiday. But a lot of people didn't bother with it at all, or didn't give presents, or it wasn't a big thing.
Yes.
So I think certainly he ushered in the... Well, in the film, of course, he ushers in the sort of concepts of generosity and goodwill to all men. And there's a tree at the end, which is a big decorated tree, and there's some discussion that, you know, obviously... Family, got these, we'll have them now.
This may catch on.
There is a bit of that. Did you know? Yeah. A tree, it's a good idea. Yes. A tree, I like that. Yes. So, and obviously, because it's a Dickensy film and it's very sort of festive, there's a lot of snow and
lovely
urchins and mob caps and sooty faced children and people skipping in the street.
Got to send it to America, haven't you?
Yeah, no, exactly. A lot of a lot of the extras in it were probably good sort of toothless old Dickensian leaded big hats.
Yes.
So yeah, it's got
which you can find in Dublin, I believe.
So, pretty much, you know, yeah. Every street. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to demean the reputation of the city.
I'll do that for you.
Yeah, no, but every street corner.
And I'm judging by the trailer purely that you seem to be in it playing. Is it the publisher or the
John Forster, who was Dickens' literary agent, and later his biographer after Dickens died, he published an acclaimed biography. But he was he came down to London from Gateshead and was called to the bar and various other things, but it was a Geordie.
Right.
Quite how strong a Geordie accent he would have had, being a sort of London gentleman who really settled in London quite early in life, I don't know. But for the purpose of the film, he has a slightly broader Geordie accent, just to sort of differentiate himself from the gentlemanliness of Dickens.
Well, from now on, we'll always think of him as sounding exactly and looking exactly like you. So
exactly,
that's
and sounding like a sort of cut-price Jimmy Nail.
That's exactly who they tried first and they got you. Right?
Yeah,
clearly. Yeah, nice.
Also, around that time was when printing became more mass popular and cheap. Yeah. So people could read in there, could see in newspapers and in magazines and stuff that this was happening. So I think that it also ties in with the sort of the invention of mass marketing. So they went, we've invented all this stuff for Christmas. Hey, we can get people to buy it.
Yeah, and you can advertise, I suppose, much more. I know they were doing stuff in sort of Cromwell's time as well, but suddenly it's cheaper and you can do it more. In that sort of time as well, you've got the emergence of the middle classes, and that's a bit of aspiration.
Aspiration, more disposable income.
Yeah.
One up with the Joneses.
All that sort of stuff, yeah, exactly, stuff. Yeah. Okay, so we can blame or thank Dickens, we think, for so many, many things.
Ah, Dickens, he gave us so many things, didn't he? One of the first major uses of Merry Christmas as a greeting. He cemented mulled wine into our drinks cabinets. Mainly he just refocused Christmas as a family and a charity-centred time, perhaps at the cost of the church, you could say. Then again, the church wasn't going great guns at that time to make Christmas as joyous a day as it now is for many of us. So family, charity, there are worse things, I would argue, to be focused on in a wintry festival. Yes, indeed, see Halloween. Christmas 1843, when Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol, the same week that Henry Cole published the first Christmas card, just about when Tom Smith was opening his cracker business just up the road. There's a lot of Christmassy stuff going on in Victorian London, 1843. My next historical guest would indeed also, I think, deserve a giant nod, and that is Prince Albert. He and Victoria gave us the Germanic Christmas by the bucket load at almost exactly the same sort of time. So the German Christmas trees, they were going up at the palace, and people were catching on, thinking this is a good idea. German craft followed, gingerbread, paper decorations, all stolen from Germany. Sorry, stolen from Germany. It's a sort of biscuity bread thing. So I reckon, in my opinion, there were three wise men at the Victorian Christmas. I mean, there were plenty, really, but let's go for three. It's a good number. So you've got Dickens, you've got Prince Albert, and I'd also say Washington Irving. He's an American author who actually gave us Santa, and he also gave us Dickens, in a way. So, yes, he's the man before the man, but we're going to get to him next time, OK, on our second Christmas episode.
Is there anything I've left out?
We haven't mentioned Jesus much, but
the trouble with Christmas is there's too many distractions, isn't there? How has it taken this long for our historical guests to include the big guy? Well, the big baby. Sorry, that sounds wrong. The baby who was the big guy, you know what I mean? The son of the big guy, whose name is, in fact, in Christmas, Christ's Mass. Jesus' birth was recorded in two of the four Gospels, with notable differences, but only a few. And the main crux of the storyline, I think, is there. Crux is probably the wrong word. It's cross. That's the end of it, isn't it? But at the birth, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, I think that's kind of what you need to know, the angelic visions, sending them on their way, the fulfilment of prophecy. But you've got differences. You've got in Matthew's Gospel, it's more male-heavy, so there's more sort of Joseph's story. He's the hero, saving the family from Herod. You've got the wise men. It's more of a chase thriller, really. In Luke's Gospel, his account is more focused on Mary, her angelic vision, and the shepherds. Excuse the cars, I am still out shopping, that is right. I'm getting some odd looks, but I'm rolling with it. I really don't mind. That's what Christmas is all about. 1,000 years after the birth of Christ, there were still two different nativity plays. One with the shepherds, one with the wise men. The Wise Men Nativity play, very popular in France, particularly on Epiphany, 6th of January, 12th night, featured a real star in this particular play, being winched across the church ceiling as priests played the Magi below. Well, not a real star, of course, but an impressive prop nonetheless, with lots of wheels and pulleys and things. So then about 1,000 years ago, like I say, the two plays started to merge. You got the Shepherds play, the Wise Men play, and they gave us our current Nativity play that my kids have roles in only next week, in fact. My daughter this year is playing a stick man. I don't know quite how that features at the Nativity. I suppose it's sticks around the manger or something. There is actually quite a good chance the Christmas play at her school is Stickman by Julia Donaldson, the second greatest story ever told, no doubt. There are other extra guests that we've added to our nativity plays over the years, though, not just Stickman or the Love Actually Octopus, but also familiar characters like the donkey. Right? There's not in the original, there's no donkey in the nativity accounts. You know, it's at the end of Jesus' life, Palm Sunday, yes, but we've added a donkey as a convenient mode of transport for Mary, I think. You think heavily pregnant, going from Nazareth to Bethlehem, it's about a week's journey. You might need a donkey, but it could be a horse, could be a cart, could be walking. Unlikely to be walking, but you never know. I think it's because we have that modern fondness for the song Little Donkey, which is actually way more modern than I even thought. It's actually a late 1950s song, a Geordie folk song. The writer, Eric Boswell, was far prouder of his comic songs like I've Got a Little Whippet. It's a very sweet little song. It goes... I've got a little whippet. This is in Geordie, of course, you've got to bear in mind. I've got a little whippet. I can't do the accent. I've got a little whippet. He's never won a race, but you never saw a whippet with a canny looking face. She's just a bit short-sighted, and it shows upon the track. But when she gets her contact lenses, man, you'll never hold her back. That's my attempt at Geordie. Justin Edwards can clearly do it in his film. I've got work to be done, I think. Interesting to know that the sequel or prequel to Little Donkey was about a whippet and it mentions contact lenses. Feels a bit more modern, doesn't it? Well, there you go.
If Jesus, if he were deposited in our modern day Christmas today, what do you think he makes of it?
Bemusement, I should think, for a lot of it. Because, I mean, apart from going to church and singing the odd carol, there's very little to do with any religious connotations with Christmas.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah, I suppose, and it seems like the Dickensian Christmas charity and family at its heart, taking sort of good Christian morals and ethics and standards and things, but they've sort of pushed out the nativity a little bit for a lot of people.
Yes,
become the new focus. But is that, you know, if Jesus here today goes, okay, you know, people are giving more at Christmas, or the Salvation Army doing their thing, food hampers, that sort of thing, got to be a good thing, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's got to be a good thing, but possibly eat less turkey, give more to charity.
Yes, yes.
Might be his initial thoughts.
Work to be done.
Yes. I've never been abroad for Christmas. I've always had a British Christmas. I would love to go and have a really, really cold and snowy Christmas, you know, in the Austrian Alps or something, where it's just like real picture postcard snowy Christmassiness.
Yes. Yeah, this, because, and again, I suppose the whole White Christmas thing I know, it's got its origins in, you know, the snowy Norse kind of Germanic stuff, but then also, since Dickens and Bing Crosby, that's why we think of the snowy Christmas, is that fair?
Yes, yeah, I mean, there was a mini Ice Age in just sort of these few years before Dickens was around, and it sort of petered out in his childhood, so he very much thought of snow being associated with the childhood Christmas, so, you know, and I think that got picked up in the likes of A Christmas Carol and Pickwick Papers, and then got pushed into our early Christmas cards and such like, and that's where we get snow from.
So on Dickens then, one more word from the man who played the man, who represented the man who invented Christmas, and that's Justin Edwards. Now, Justin has a stage character, Jeremy Lyon, a very wrong children's party entertainer. It is a hoot. It honestly is. It's a wonderful piece of work. Jeremy Lyon's 12 Days of Christmas, told via the 12 Drinks of Christmas, is a marvel to behold. And we'll put the link in the podcast info.
I think probably many of us have strong memories of seeing you on stage has been Jeremy Lyon.
Which is very much a Christmas.
And a Christmas, it's a favourite, isn't it?
It is. I get asked every year. I do, this year I'm only doing one at Broadway because I'm tied up with other things. So I'm doing one at the Brasserie ZL next week about this sort of.
Well, you want to do
one
that's good. I just want to know you're doing one.
Exactly.
Keeping it handy.
Whereas last year, or was it the year before, I was doing Henning Venn's Christmas sort of run, and I did sort of 10. And it's just a bit tiring now to do the 12 Days of Christmas. Yeah, it was all right when I was a younger man, but older with children. So But no, so that's always a firm. That's every year. It sort of the YouTube wraps up another.
Yes.
However many thousand views.
Oh, good. It's on YouTube. That's fine. Yeah. That's all we need to know. Yeah. Because I've experienced it live, and I haven't delved further into that. But
it's on the internet. It's on YouTube in many incarnations, in fact. Because I did it for BBC Four. Someone's put that. I did it for ITV once, and I did it for the Rob Brydon Show. So there's three. You can compare and contrast.
Oh, well,
the three different versions.
Direct online. People to that from this.
They don't. There was very small variations.
It is quite much. Brilliant. Yeah. Good on you. Justin, thank you so much indeed.
No problem.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you. Absolutely.
Yes, so Jeremy Lyon's 12 Drinks of Christmas. Do seek it out on YouTube. Speaking of bottles, inappropriate to do that sort of link, but this is a Bring a Bottle podcast. Each episode, we pick one thing you can do to help us out. So last time it was leave a had a nice review on Amazon or Goodreads for my new book, Heart the Biography of Christmas. Thank you if you did that. Very good of you. This time, you'll bring a bottle request. We ask nothing more than a visit to a website. You can visit jamescooperswhychristmas.com. Plenty there for your festive browsing. And I'm also blogging about the history of Christmas on my Yule blog, as we're calling it, which is kneeldownstandup, all one word, kneeldownstandup.wordpress.com. If you want to find it without that link, I do just post it each day on my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/paul.carenza, or just search for Paul Carenza, and you'll find each day I'm posting a little festive treat from that Yule blog. But yes, so simple as that. Visit Why Christmas, that's W-H-Y Christmas, all one word, .com. And that's our guest James's pretty definitive Christmas website, and or my blog is kneeldownstandup.wordpress.com or on the Facebook page. Have a read, share it on your social meds if you like it, and thank you. Oh, my new Christmas history book is, of course, still very much available if you fancy ordering it in time for Christmas. I'm just not imploring you to buy it this week. I'm just gently nudging you towards it. I say gently. This entire episode is actually based on the book, so maybe not that gently.
Best Christmas song?
Carol in the Bleak Midwinter.
Excellent.
Non-carol Jingle Bells, because everybody thinks it's a cute Christmas song. It's actually a Thanksgiving song about drink driving and picking up women.
How is it about drink driving and picking up? I mean, Thanksgiving song I could understand. You know, if it's a song for Thanksgiving, so be it. But how is it a drink driving song?
Okay, just look at the words and the ones that we don't normally sing, basically.
It's the forgotten verses.
Yes, if you read the forgotten verses, it's about driving snow carriages in the snow fast, possibly having a few before you did so, and finding a rather nice young lady to accompany you on such a journey.
Shocking.
Yes,
shocking.
And then all the cute little three-year-olds sing it in their nativity scene.
I see. Nice, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jingle bells, any bells on sleigh bells and all that, were all meant to be to get out of the way, isn't it?
It's the pre-invention of the horn.
Best Christmas pop song, you know, so over the last few decades?
Probably, it's got to be the classic Slade, just because, it keeps Noddy Holder going, basically.
It does, so. he's doing well. He comes out every year like the groundhog and just pokes his head out and does all of that. Best Christmas special of anything on TV? Is there a best, I don't know, TV special?
I think the Dad's Army ones
still
hold up very well. Because I think they just... The Christmas dinner episode of Dad's Army, where they a turkey goes mislaid from a farm, shall we say.
Right.
So they dish it all up to the old people.
Excellent.
It's got... Captain Marinering in his best suit, getting gravy poured all over him and such like. So, you know.
Best Christmas film?
The Muppet Christmas Carol.
Good, absolutely. You're correct. That is
because
the correct
it's by
answer.
Far the most accurate version that's ever been made.
It's incredible, isn't it? The Muppets got it right. I love that.
Yeah.
Because then they get the. Is it Gonzo, I think, is the narrator? Yes. He's basically Dickens, isn't he? And he just fills in the gaps.
There's an awful. You sort of get these read-alonger audiobooks you can get. I mean, you can almost do read-alonger Christmas Carol with the Muppet Christmas Carol because there's actually so much of the original words in it.
That's good. You can't knock that, can you? You can't knock that. I saw the Muppet Christmas Carol before I read the book, obviously, as indeed most of us did. I not realise that big... is it the Ghost of Christmas Present, the big guy?
Yes.
And then, of course, you read the book and you see the illustrations and go, oh, yeah, that is the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, and he's apparently, was Dickens wrote to, it's like representing the Saturnalian origins
of
Christmas.
Let's get drunk, everybody, roots of Christmas.
The man who invented Christmas. It's in cinemas now. See Justin Edwards in that. Thank you to Justin. Thank you to James. We'll have more from Justin on a future podcast, I think, as well. And more from James on our second Christmas special, which will be out in just a couple of weeks' time. Probably, well, hopefully before Christmas. That would be nice. On that, we'll have five more historical festive guests, two more live festive guests. Next time features Santa, Gotham City, A Child's Impression, A Pooing Spaniard, and KFC. Hey, you, has anybody said to you today? Have a great rest of Christmas build-up. Advent, I think they call it. Made the world a better place. More festive goodness on the next one. You look positively beautiful in your blue jeans. Do share this episode. Point people towards it. Subscribe, rate, spread word of us. Park, the Biography of Christmas is available now. Thank you to Rob Halligan for the music as ever. More festive joy in a couple of weeks, and God bless us, everyone.